17. The South End of the Key. 1. I next remember a wireman coming along and picking me up. I remember walking a few steps, then recalling that Ilsa was dead and collapsing to my knees. And the most shameful thing was that, even though I was heartbroken, I was also hungry, starving. I remember Wireman helping me in through the open door and telling me it was all a bad dream, that I'd been having the horrors, and when I told him no, it was true. Mary Iyer had done it. Mary Iyer had drowned Ilsa in Ilsa's own bathtub. He had laughed and said now he knew it. For one horrible moment, I believed him. I pointed to the answering machine. "Play the message," I said, and went into the kitchen. Staggered into the kitchen. When Pam started in again, Edgar, the police called, and they say Illy's dead. I was eating fistfuls of frosted mini-wheat straight from the box. I had a queer sense of being part of a prepared slide. Soon I would be placed under a microscope and studied. In the other room, the message ended. Wireman cursed and played it again. I kept eating cereal. The time I'd spent on the beach before Wireman came along was missing. That part of my memory was as blank as my early hospital stay after my accident. I took a final handful of cereal, crammed it into my mouth, and swallowed. It stuck in my throat, and that was good. That was fine. I hoped it would choke me. I deserved to choke. Then it slid down. I went shuffle limping back into the living room. Wireman was standing beside the answering machine, wide-eyed. "Edgar, muchacho, what in God's name?" "One of the paintings," I said, and kept on shuffling. Now that I had something in my stomach, I wanted some more oblivion. If only for a little while. Only it was more than wanting, actually, it was needing. I had broken the broom handle. Then Wireman came along. What was in the ellipsis? I didn't know. I decided I didn't want to know. The paintings? Mary Iyer bought one. I'm sure it was one from the Girl in the Ship series. And she took it with her. We should have known. I should have known. Wireman, I need to lie down. I need to sleep. 2 hours, okay? Then wake me and we'll go to the South End. Edgar, you can't. I don't expect you to... After... I stopped to look at him. It felt as though my head weighed 100 pounds, but I managed. She doesn't expect me to either, but this ends today. 2 hours. Big Pink's open door faced east, and the morning sun struck brightly across Wireman's face, lighting a compassion so strong I could barely look at it. Okay, muchacho. 2 hours. In the meantime, try to keep everyone clear. I don't know if he heard that last part or not. I was facing into my bedroom by then, and the words were trailing away. I fell onto my bed, and there was Reba. For a moment, I considered throwing her across the room, as I had considered throwing the phone. Instead, I gathered her to me and pressed my face against her boneless body and began to cry. I was still crying when I fell asleep. 2. Wake up. Someone was shaking me. Wake up, Edgar. If we're going to do this, we have to get rolling. I don't know. I'm not sure he's going to come around. That voice was Jack's. Edgar. Wireman slapped first one side of my face, then the other. Not gently, either. Bright light struck my closed eyes, flooding my world with red. I tried to get away from all these stimuli. There were bad things waiting on the other side of my eyelids. But Wireman wouldn't let me. Muchacho, wake up. It's 10 past 11. That got through. I sat up and looked at him. He was holding the bedside lamp in front of my face, so close I could feel the heat from the bulb. Jack was standing behind him. The realization that Ilsa was dead, my Illy, struck at my heart, but I pushed it away. 11. Wireman, I told you 2 hours. What if some of Elizabeth's relatives decide to... Easy, muchacho. I called the funeral home and told them to keep everyone off Duma. I said that all three of us had come down with German measles. Very contagious. I also called Dario and told him about your daughter. Everything with the pictures is on hold, at least for now. I doubt if that's a priority with you, but... Of course it is. I got to my feet and rubbed my hand over my face. Percy doesn't get to do any more damage than she already has. I'm sorry, Edgar, Jack said. So damn sorry for your loss. I know that doesn't carry much water, but it does, I said, and maybe in time it would. If I kept saying it, if I kept reaching out. My accident really taught me just one thing. The only way to go on is to go on. To say I can do this even when you know you can't. I saw that one of them had brought the rest of my clothes, but for today's work I'd want the boots in the closet instead of the sneakers at the foot of the bed. Jack was wearing Georgia Giants and a long-sleeved shirt. That was good. Wireman, will you put on coffee? I asked. Do we have time? We'll have to make time. There's stuff I need, but what I need first is to wake up. You guys can use a little fuel, too, maybe. Jack, help me with my boots, would you? Wireman left for the kitchen. Jack knelt, eased on my boots, and tied them for me. How much do you know? I asked him. More than I want to, he said. But I don't understand any of it. I talked to that woman, Mary Iyer, at your show. I liked her. I did, too. Wireman called your wife while you were sleeping. She wouldn't talk to him very long, so then he called some guy he met at your show, Mr. Bozeman. Tell me. Edgar, are you sure? Tell me. Pam's version had been broken and fragmentary, and even that was no longer clear in my mind. The details were obscured by an image of Ilse's hair floating on the surface of an overflowing bathtub. That might or might not be accurate, but it was hellishly bright, hellishly particular, and it had blotted out almost everything else. Mr. Bozeman said the police found no sign of forced entry, so they think your daughter must have let her in, even though it was the middle of the night. Or Mary just hit buzzers until somebody else let her in. My missing arm itched. It was a deep itch. Sleepy, dreamy almost. Then she walked up to Illy's apartment and rang the bell. Let's say that she pretended to be someone else. Edgar, are you guessing, or? Let's say she pretended to be from a gospel group called the Hummingbirds. And let's say she called through that door that something bad had happened to Carson Jones. Who's? Only, she calls him Smiley, and that's the convincer. Wireman was back. So was the floating Edgar. Edgar down below saw all the mundane things of a sunshiny Florida morning on Duma Key. Edgar over my head saw more, not everything. Just enough to be too much. What happened then, Edgar? Wireman asked. He spoke very softly. What do you think? Let's say Illy opens the door, and when she does, she finds a woman pointing a gun at her. She knows this woman from somewhere, but she's been through one bad scare already that night. She's disoriented, and she can't place her. Her memory chokes. Maybe it's just as well. Mary tells her to turn around. And when she does that, I began to cry again. Edgar, man, don't, Jack said. He was almost crying himself. This is just guesswork. It's not guesswork, Wireman said. Let him talk. But why do we need to know? Jack, muchacho, we don't know what we need to know, so let the man talk. I heard their voices, but from far away. Let's say Mary hit her with the gun when she turned around. I wiped my cheeks with the heel of my hand. Let's say she hit her several times, four or five. In the movies, you get clopped once and you're out like a light. In real life, I doubt if it's like that. No, Wireman murmured. And of course, this game of let's say turned out to be all too accurate. My if-so girl's skull had been fractured in three places from repeated overhand blows, and she'd bled a great deal. Mary dragged her. The blood trail led across the living room kitchen, the smell of the burnt sketch very likely still hanging in the air, and down the short hallway between the bedroom and the nook that served as Illy's study. In the bathroom at the end of the hall, Mary filled the tub and in it she drowned my unconscious daughter like an orphan kitten. When the job was done, Mary went into the living room, sat down on the sofa, and shot herself in the mouth. The bullet exited the top of her skull, splattering her ideas about art, along with a good deal of her hair, on the living room wall behind her. It was then just shy of 4 a.m. The man downstairs was an insomniac who knew the gunshot for what it was and called the police. "Why drown her?" Wireman asked. "I don't understand that." "Because it's Percy's way," I thought. "We're not going to think about that right now," I said. "All right?" He reached out and squeezed my remaining hand. "All right, Edgar. And if we get this business done, maybe we'll never have to," I thought. But I had drawn my daughter. I was sure of it. I'd drawn her on the beach. My dead daughter. My drowned daughter. Drawn in sand for the waves to take. "You will want to," Elizabeth had said, "but you mustn't." Oh, but Elizabeth, sometimes we have no choice. 3. We swallowed strong coffee in Big Pink's sunny kitchen until sweat was standing out on our cheeks. I took 3 aspirin, adding another layer of caffeine, then sent Jack to get 2 artisan pads, and I told him to sharpen every colored pencil he could find while he was upstairs. Wireman filled a plastic carry sack with supplies from the fridge, carrot stubs, cucumber strips, a 6-pack of Pepsi, 3 large bottles of Evian water, some roast beef, and one of Jack's astronaut chickens, still in its see-through capsule. "Surprised you can even think of food," he said with the tiniest touch of reproach. "Food doesn't interest me in the slightest," I said, "but I may have to draw stuff. In fact, I'm positive I'll have to draw stuff, and that seems to burn calories by the carload." Jack returned with the pads and pencils. I pawed it over, then sent him back upstairs for art gum erasers. I suspected there would be more stuff I'd want, isn't there always? But I couldn't think what it might be. I glanced at the clock. It was 10 to 12. "Did you Polaroid the drawbridge?" I asked Jack. "Please tell me you did." "Yeah, but I thought the German measles story..." "Let me see the photos," I said. Jack reached into his back pocket and produced some Polaroids. He shuffled through them and handed me 4, which I dealt out on the kitchen table like a shorthand of solitaire. I grabbed one of the artisan pads and quickly began sketching the photo that showed the cogs and chains under the opening drawbridge. It was just a dinky little one-lane thing, the most clearly. My right arm continued to itch, a low, sleepy crawl. "The German measles story was genius," I said. "It will keep almost everyone away, but almost isn't good enough. Mary wouldn't have stayed away from my daughter if someone had told her Illy had chicken po-" Fuck. My eyes had blurred, and a line that should have been true wandered off into falsehood. "Take it easy, Edgar," Wireman said. I glanced at the clock. 11:58 now. The drawbridge would go up at noon. It always did. I blinked away the tears and went back to my sketch. Machinery spun itself into existence from the point of the Venus Black. And even now, with Ilsa gone, the fascination of seeing something real emerge from nothing, like a shape drifting out of the fog bank, stole over me. And why not? When better? It was refuge. "If she's got someone to attack us with and the drawbridge is out of commission, she'll just send them around to the Don Pedro Island footbridge," Wireman said. Without looking up from my drawing, I said, "Maybe not. A lot of people don't know about the Sunshine Walkway, and I'm positive Percy doesn't." "Why?" "Because it was built in the 50s. You told me that, and she was sleeping then." He considered this a moment, then said, "You think she can be beaten, don't you?" "Yes, I do. Not killed, maybe, but put back to sleep." "Do you know how?" "Find the leak in the table and fix it," I almost said, but that made no sense. "Not yet. There are more of Libet's pictures at the other house, the one at the south end of the quay. They'll tell us where Percy is and tell me what to do." "How do you know there are more?" "Because there have to be," I would have said, but just then the noon horn went. 1/4 mile down the road, the drawbridge between Duma Key and Casey Key, the only north link between us and the coast, was going up. I counted to 20, putting Mississippi between each number as I had when I was a child. Then I erased the biggest cog in my drawing. There was a sensation when I did it. In the missing arm, yes, but also centered between and just above my eyes, of doing some lovely piece of precision work. Okay, I said. Can we go now? Wireman asked. Not quite yet, I said. He glanced at the clock, then back at me.
I thought you were in a hurry, amigo. And given what we saw in here last night, I know that I am. So what else?
I need to draw you both, I said. 4.
I'd love to have you do a picture of me, Edgar, Jack said, and I'm sure my mom would be totally blissed out, but I think Wireman's right. We ought to get going.
Have you ever been to the south end of the Key, Jack?
No.
Of that, I'd been almost sure, but as I tore the picture of the drawbridge machinery off the top of my pad, I looked at Wireman. In spite of the lead that now seemed to be lining my heart and emotions, I found that this was something I really wanted to know. What about you? Ever been down to the original Heron's Roost for a little poke and pry?
Actually, no.
Wireman went to the window and looked out.
Drawbridge is still up. I can see the western leaf against the sky from here. So far, so good.
I was not to be diverted so easily.
Why not?
Miss Eastlake advised against it, he said, still not turning from the window. She said the environment was bad, groundwater, flora, even the air. She said the Army Air Corps did testing off the south end of Duma during World War II and managed to poison that end of the island, which is probably why the foliage grows so rank in most places. She said the poison oak is maybe the worst in America, worse than syphilis before penicillin is how she put it. Take years to get rid of if you rub up against it. Looks like it's gone, then it comes back, and it's everywhere, so she said.
This was mildly interesting, but Wireman still hadn't actually answered my question, so I asked it again.
She also claimed there are snakes, he said, finally turning around. I have a horror of snakes. Have ever since I was a little boy and woke up one morning on a camping trip with my folks to discover I was sharing my sleeping bag with a Milky. It had actually worked its way into my undershirt. It sprayed me with musk. I thought I was fucking poisoned. Are you satisfied?
Yes, I said. Did you tell her that story before or after she told you about the snake infestation on the south end?
Stiffly, he said. I don't remember.
Then he sighed.
Probably before. I see what you're saying. She wanted to keep me away.
I didn't say it, you did, I thought. What I said was, it's mostly Jack I'm worried about, but it's better to be safe.
Me?
Jack looked startled.
I don't have anything against snakes, and I know what poison oak and poison ivy look like. I was a Boy Scout.
Trust me on this, I said, and began to sketch him. I worked quickly, resisting the urge to go into detail, as part of me seemed to want to do. While I was working, the first angry car horn began to honk on the coast side of the drawbridge.
Sounds to me like the drawbridge is stuck again, Jack said.
Yes, I agreed, not looking up from my drawing. 5. I sped along even more quickly with Wireman's sketch, but I again found myself having to fight the urge to fall into the work, because when I was in the work, the pain and grief were at bay. The work was like a drug. But there would be only so much daylight, and I didn't want to meet Emery again any more than Wireman did. What I wanted was for this to be over, and for the three of us to be off island, far off island, by the time those sunset colors started to rise out of the gulf.
Okay, I said.
I had done Jack in blue and Wireman in blaze orange. Neither was perfect, but I thought both sketches caught the essentials. There's just one more thing.
Wireman groaned.
Edgar. Nothing I need to draw, I said, and flipped the cover of the pad closed on the two sketches. Just smile for the artist, Wireman. But before you do, think of something that makes you feel particularly good.
Are you serious?
As a heart attack. His brow furrowed, then smoothed out. He smiled. As always, it lit up his whole face and made him a new man. I turned to Jack. Now you. And because I really did feel that he was the more important of the two, I watched him very closely when he did. 6.
We didn't have a four-wheel drive, but Elizabeth's old Mercedes sedan seemed a reasonable substitute. It was built like a tank. We drove to El Palacio in Jack's car and parked just inside the gate. Jack and I switched our supplies over to the SEL 500. Wireman's job was the picnic basket. "A few other things while you're in there, if you can," I said. "Bug spray and a really good flashlight. Have you got one of those?" He nodded. "There's an 8-cell job in the gardening shed. It's a searchlight." "Good. And wireman." He gave me a what-now look, the exasperated kind you do mostly with your eyebrows, but said nothing. "The spear pistol?" He actually grinned. "Sí, señor. Para fijaciono." While he was gone, I stood leaning against the Mercedes, looking at the tennis court. The door at the far end had been left open. Elizabeth's semi-domesticated heron was inside, standing by the net. It looked at me with accusing blue eyes. "Edgar?" Jack touched my elbow. "Okay?" I was not okay and wouldn't be okay for a long time again. But I can do this, I thought. I have to do this. She does not get to win. "Fine," I said. "I don't like it that you're so pale. You look like you did when you first came here." Jack's voice cracked on the last couple of words. "I'm fine," I said again, and briefly cupped the back of his neck. I realized that other than shaking his hand, it was probably the only time I had touched him. Wireman came out clutching the handles of the picnic basket in both hands. He had three long-billed hats stacked on his head. John Eastlake's harpoon pistol was tucked under his arm. "Flashlights in the basket," he said. "Ditto deep woods off and three pairs of gardening gloves I found in the shed." "Brilliant," I said. "See, but it's 1:15, Edgar. If we're going, can we please go?" I looked at the heron on the tennis court. It stood by the net, as still as a hand on a broken clock, and looked back at me pitilessly. That was all right. It is, for the most part, a pitiless world. "Yes," I said. "Let's go." 7. Now I had memory. It was no longer in perfect working order, and to this day I sometimes get confused about names and the order in which certain things happened. But every moment of our expedition to the house at the south end of Duma Key remains clear in my mind, like the first movie that ever amazed me, or the first painting that ever took my breath away, The Hailstorm by Thomas Hart Benton. Yet at first I felt cold, divorced from it all, like a slightly jaded patron of the arts looking at a picture in a second-rate museum. It wasn't until Jack found the doll inside the staircase going up to nowhere that I started to realize I was in the picture instead of just looking at it, and there was no going back for any of us unless we could stop her. I knew she was strong. If she could reach all the way to Omaha and Minneapolis to get what she wanted, then all the way to Providence to keep it, of course she was strong. And still I underestimated her. Until we were actually in that house at the south end of Duma Key, I didn't realize how strong Percy was. 8. I wanted Jack to drive, and Wireman to sit in the back seat. When Wireman asked why, I said I had my reasons, and I thought they'd become apparent in short order. "And if I'm wrong about that," I added, "no one will be any more delighted than me." Jack backed onto the road and turned south. More out of curiosity than anything else, I punched on the radio and was rewarded with Billy Ray Cyrus bellowing about his achy, breaky heart. Jack groaned and reached for it, probably meaning to find the bone. Before he could, Billy Ray was swallowed in a burst of deafening static.
"Jesus, turn it off," Wireman yelped.
But first I turned it down. Reducing the volume made no difference. If anything, the static grew louder. I could feel it rattling the fillings of my teeth, and I punched the off button before my eardrums could start bleeding.
"What was that?" Jack asked.
He had pulled over. His eyes were wide. "Call it bad environment, why don't you?" I said. "A little something left over from those Army Air Corps tests 60 years ago.
"Very funny," Wireman said.
Jack was looking at the radio. "I want to try it again." Be my guest, I told him, and placed my hand over my left ear. Jack pushed the power button. The static that came roaring out of the Mercedes' four speakers this time seemed as loud as a jet fighter's engine. Even with my palm over one ear, it ripped through my head. I thought I heard Wireman yell, but I wasn't sure. Jack pushed the power button again, and the hellish blizzard of noise cut out. I think we should skip the tunes, he said. Wireman, all right? My voice seemed to be coming from far away, through a steady, low-ringing noise. Rockin', he said. 9. Jack might have made it a little way beyond the point where Ilsa got sick. Maybe not. It was hard to tell once the growth got high. The road narrowed to a stripe, its surface humped and buckled by the roots running beneath it. The foliage had interlaced above us, blotting out most of the sky. It was like being in a living tunnel. The windows were rolled up, but even so, the car was filling with a green and fecund jungle smell. Jack tested the old Mercedes springs on a particularly egregious pothole, thumped up over a ridge in the pavement on the far side, then slammed to a stop and put the transmission in park. I'm sorry, he said. His mouth was quivering and his eyes were too big. I knew perfectly well what he was. Jack fumbled open the door, leaned out, and vomited. I thought the smell of the jungle, that's what it was once you were a mile past El Palacio, was strong in the car. But what came rolling in with the door open was 10 times headier, thick and green and viciously alive. Yet I did not hear a single bird calling in that mass of junk foliage. The only sound was Jack losing his breakfast. Then his lunch. At last he collapsed back against the seat. He thought I looked like a snowbird again. That was sort of funny because on that early afternoon in mid-April, Jack Cantore was as pale as March in Minnesota. Instead of 21, he looked a sickly 45. It must have been the tuna salad, Ilsa had said. But it hadn't been the tuna. Something from the sea, all right, but not the tuna. I'm sorry, he said. I don't know what's wrong with me. That smell, I guess. That rotten jungle smell. His chest hitched. He made a gurk sound deep in his throat and leaned out the door again. That time he missed his hold on the steering wheel, and if I hadn't grabbed him by the collar and yanked him back, he would have gone sprawling face first into his own whoop. He leaned back, eyes closed, face wet with sweat, panting rapidly. We better take him back to El Palacio, Wireman said. I don't like to lose the time. Hell, I don't like to lose him, but this shit ain't right. As far as Percy's concerned, it's exactly right, I said. Now my bad leg was itching almost as much as my arm. It felt like electricity. It's her little poison belt. How about you, Wireman? How's your gut? Fine, but my bad eye, the one that used to be bad, is itching like a bastard and my head's kind of humming. Probably from that damn radio. It's not the radio. And the reason it's getting to Jack and not to us is because we've been, well, call it immunized. Sort of ironic, isn't it? Behind the wheel, Jack groaned. What can you do for him, muchacho? Anything? I think so. I hope so. I had my pads on my lap and my pencils and erasers in a belt pack. Now I flipped to the picture of Jack and found one of my art gum erasers. I took away his mouth and the lower arcs of his eyes, all the way up to the corners. The itching in my right arm was fiercer than ever, and I actually had no doubt that what I planned to do would work. I summoned up the memory of Jack's smile in my kitchen, the one I'd asked him to give me, while thinking of something particularly good, and drew it quickly with my midnight blue pencil. It took no more than 30 seconds. The eyes were really the key. When it comes to smiles, they always are. But those few lines changed the whole idea of Jack Cantore's face. And I got something I hadn't expected. As I drew, I saw him kissing a girl in a bikini. No, more than saw, I could feel her smooth skin, even a few little grains of sand nestling in the hollow at the small of her back. I could smell her shampoo and taste a faint ghost of salt on her lips. I knew her name was Caitlin, and he called her Kate. I put my pencil back in a little belt pack and zipped it closed. Jack? Speaking quietly. His eyes were closed, and sweat still stood out on his cheeks and forehead, but I thought his breathing had slowed. How are you now? Any better? Yeah, he said without opening his eyes. What did you do?
Well, as long as it's just the three of us, we might as well call it what it is. Magic. A little counterspell I tossed your way.
Wireman reached over my shoulder, picked up the pad, studied the picture, and nodded.
I'm beginning to believe she should have left you alone, muchacho.
I said, it was my daughter she should have left alone. 10. We stayed where we were for 5 minutes, letting Jack get his second wind. At last he said he felt able to go on. His collar was back. I wondered if we would have run into the same problems if we had gone round by water.
Wireman, have you seen any fishing boats anchored off the south end of the quay?
He considered.
You know, I haven't. They usually stay on the Don Pedro side of the strait. That's odd, isn't it?
It's not odd, it's fucking sinister, Jack said.
Like this road.
It was down to nothing but a strip. Sea grape and banyan branches scraped along the sides of the slowly trundling Mercedes, making hellish screeing sounds. The road, lumped upward with tunneling roots and broken down to gravel and potholes in some places, continued to bend inland, and now it had also begun to climb. We crept along, mile after slow mile, with the leaves and branches slapping and whacking. I kept expecting the robe to break down entirely, but the thick interlacing foliage overhead had protected it from the elements to some degree, and it never quite did. The banyans gave way to an impressive forest of Brazilian peppers, and there we saw our first wildlife, a huge bobcat that stood for a moment in the rubbly remains of the road, hissing at us with its ears laid flat, then fled into the underbrush. A little farther on, a dozen plump black caterpillars fell onto the windshield and burst open, spreading gummy guts that the wipers and washer fluid could do little to clear. They only spread the remains around until looking out through the windshield was like looking out of an eye with a cataract on it. I told Jack to stop. I got out, opened the trunk, and found a little supply of clean rags. I used one to wipe the windshield, being careful to don a pair of the gloves Wireman had found. I was already wearing a hat. But so far as I could tell, they were only caterpillars, messy but not supernatural.
Not bad, Jack said from the open driver's side window. Now I'll pop the hood so you can check the...
He stopped, looking beyond me. I turned. The road was down to little more than a path, cluttered with old chunks of asphalt and overgrown with creeping oxeye. Crossing it, about 30 yards up, was a line of 5 frogs the size of cocker spaniel puppies. The first 3 were a brilliant solid green that rarely, if ever, occurs in nature. The 4th was blue. The 5th was a faded orange that might once have been red. They were smiling. But there was something fixed and weary about those smiles. They were hopping slowly as if their hoppers were almost busted. Like the bobcat, they reached the underbrush and disappeared into it.
What the blue fuck were those? Jack asked.
Ghosts, I said. Leftovers from a little girl's powerful imagination. And they won't last much longer from the look of them. I got back in. Go on, Jack, let's ride while we can. He began to creep forward again. I asked Wireman what time it was. 2:00. We were able to ride all the way to the gate of the first heron's roost. I would never have bet on it, but we did. The foliage closed in one final time, banyans and scrub pines choked with gray beards of Spanish moss. But Jack pulled the Mercedes through, and all at once the undergrowth drew back. Here the elements had washed the tar away completely, and the end of the road was only a ruddy memory. But it was good enough for the Mercedes, which jounced and bucketed up a long hill toward 2 stone pillars. A great unruly hedge, easily 18 feet high and God knew how thick, ran away from the pillars on either side. It had also begun to spread fat green fingers down the hill toward the jungle growth. There were gates, but they stood rusty and halfway open. I didn't think the Mercedes would quite fit. This last stretch of road was flanked on both sides by ancient Australian pines of imposing height. I looked for upside-down birds and saw none. I saw none of the right-side-up variety either, for that matter, although I could now hear the faint buzz of insects. Jack stopped at the gate and looked at us apologetically. This old girl ain't fitting through that. We got out. Wireman paused to look at the ancient lichen-encrusted plaques fixed to the pillars. The one on the left said Heron's Roost. The one on the right said Eastlake. But below it, something else had been scratched, as if with the point of a knife. Once it might have been hard to read, but the lichen growing from the little cuts gouged in the metal made it stand out. Abyssus, abyssum, invocat. Any idea what that means? I asked Wireman. Indeed I do. It's a warning often given to new lawyers after they pass their bar exams. The liberal translation is, one misstep leads to another. The literal translation is, hell invokes hell. He looked at me bleakly, then back at the message below the family name. I have an idea that might have been John Eastlake's final verdict before leaving this version of Heron's Roost forever. Jack reached out to touch the jagged motto, then seemed to think better of it. Wireman did it for him. The verdict, gentlemen, and rendered in the law's own language. Come on. Sunset at 7:15, give or take, and daylight's a fleeting thing. We take turns with the picnic basket. It's one heavy puta. 11. But before we went anywhere, we paused inside the gate for a good look at Elizabeth's first home on Duma Key. My immediate reaction was dismay. Somewhere in the back of my mind had been a clear narrative thread. We'd enter the house, go upstairs, and find what had been Elizabeth's bedroom in those long-ago days when she'd been known as Libet. There my missing arm, sometimes known as Edgar Fremantle's divine psychic dowser, would lead me to a left-behind steamer trunk, or perhaps only a humble crate. Inside would be more drawings, the missing drawings, the ones that would tell me where Percy was and solve the riddle of the leaky table all before sundown. A pretty tale and only one problem with it. The top half of Heron's Roost no longer existed. The house was on an exposed knoll and its upper stories had been torn completely away in some long-ago storm. The ground floor still stood, but it was engulfed in gray-green vines which had also swarmed up the pillars in front. Spanish moss hung from the eaves, turning the veranda into a cave. The house was ringed with shattered orange tiles, all that remained of the roof. They poked up like giant's teeth from the swale of weeds that had replaced the lawn. The last 25 yards of the shell drive had been buried in strangler fig. So had the tennis court, and what might once have been a child's playhouse. More vines crept up the sides of the long barn-like outbuilding behind the court, and scrabbled along what remained of the playhouse's shingles. What's that? Jack was pointing between the tennis court and the main house. There a long rectangle of evil black soup simmered in the afternoon sun. Most of the bug drones seemed to be coming from that direction. Now I'd call it a tar pit, Wireman said. Back in the roaring 20s, I imagine the Eastlake family called it their swimming pool. Imagine taking a dip in that, Jack said and shuddered. The pool was surrounded by willows. Behind it was another thick stand of Brazilian peppers and— Wireman, are those banana trees? I asked. Yep, he said, and probably full of snakes. Ugh. Look on the west side, Edgar. On the gulf side of Heron's Roost, the snarl of weeds, vines, and creepers that had once been John Eastlake's lawn gave way to sea oats. The breeze was good and the view was better, making me realize that the one thing you rarely got in Florida was height. Here we had just enough to make it seem like the Gulf of Mexico was at our feet. Don Pedro Island was to our left, Casey Key dreaming away in a blue-gray haze to our right. Drawbridge is still up, Jack said, sounding amused. They're really having problems this time. Wireman, I said, look down there, along that old path. Do you see there? He followed my pointing finger. The rock outcropping? Sure, I see it. Not coral, I don't think. Although I'd have to get a little closer to be sure. What about it? Quit being a geologist for a minute and just look. What do you see? He looked. They both did. It was Jack who got it first. A profile? Then he said it again without the hesitation. A profile. I nodded. We can only see the forehead, the indentation of the eye socket, and the top of the nose from here, but I bet if we were on the beach, we'd see a mouth as well. Or what passed for one. That's Hag's Rock. And Shade Beach right below it, I'll bet you anything. Where John Eastlake went on his treasure hunting expeditions. And where the twins drowned, Wireman added. That's the path they walked to get there, only... He fell silent. The breeze tugged at our hair. We looked at the path, still visible after all these years. Little feet going down to swim hadn't done that. A footpath between Heron's Roost and Shade Beach would have disappeared in 5 years, maybe only two. That's no path, Jack said, reading my mind. That used to be a road. Not paved, but a road just the same. Why would anybody want a road between their house and the beach, when it couldn't have been more than a 10-minute walk? Wireman shook his head. Don't know. Edgar? Not a clue. Maybe he found more stuff on the bottom than just a few trinkets, Jack said. Maybe, but... I caught movement in the tail of my eye, something dark, and turned toward the house. I saw nothing. What is it? Wireman asked. Probably nerves, I said. The breeze, which had been coming at us from the gulf, switched slightly and puffed out of the south instead. It brought a stench of putridity with it. Jack recoiled, grimacing. The fuck is that? Perfume from the pool would be my guess, Wireman said. Jack, I love the smell of sludge in the morning. Yeah, but it's afternoon. Wireman gave him a duh look, then turned to me. What do you think, muchacho? On we go? I took a quick inventory. Wireman had the red basket, Jack had the bag with the food in it, I had my art supplies. I wasn't sure just what we were going to do if the rest of Elizabeth's drawings had blown away in the storm that had torn the roof off the ruin just ahead, or if there were no more pictures. But we had come this far, and we had to do something. Ilsa insisted on that, from my bones and heart. Yes, I said. On we go. 12. We had reached the point where the driveway began to be overgrown with strangler fig when I saw that black thing go flickering through the high tangle of weeds to the right of the house. This time Jack saw it too. Something's there, he said. I didn't see anyone, Wireman said. He set down the picnic basket and armed sweat from his brow. Switch with me a while, Jack. You take the basket and I'll take the food. You're young and strong. Wireman's old and used up. He'll die soon. Holy shit, what's that? He staggered back from the basket and would have fallen if I hadn't caught him around the waist. Jack shouted with surprise and horror. The man came bursting out from the undergrowth just ahead on our left. There was no way he could have been there. Jack and I had glimpsed him 50 yards away only seconds before, but he was. He was a black man, but not a human being. We never mistook him for an actual human being. For one thing, his legs, cocked and clad in blue breeches, did not move as he passed in front of us. Nor did he stir the thick mat of strangler fig springing up all around him. Yet his lips grinned, his eyes rolled with jolly malevolence. He wore a peaked cap with a button on top, and that was somehow the worst. I thought if I had to look at that cap for long, it would drive me mad. The thing disappeared into the grass on our right, a black man in blue breeches about 5.5 feet tall. The grass was no more than 5 feet high, and simple mathematics said he had no business disappearing into it, but he did. A moment later, it was on the porch, grinning at us like the old family retainer, and then, with no pause, it was at the bottom of the steps, and once more darting into the weeds, grinning at us all the time. Grinning at us from beneath its cap. Its cap was red. Jack turned to flee. There was nothing on his face but mindless, blabbering panic. I let go of Wireman to grab him, and if Wireman had also decided to flee, I think that would have been the end of our expedition. I had only one arm, after all, and couldn't restrain them both. Couldn't restrain either of them if they really meant to turn tail. Terrified as I was, I never even came close to running, and Wireman, God bless him, stood his ground, watching with his mouth hung open as the black man next appeared from the grove of banana trees between the pool and the outbuilding. I got Jack by the belt and yanked him back. I couldn't slap him in the face, I had no hand to slap with, so I settled for shouting. It's not real. It's her nightmare.
Her nightmare?
Something like comprehension dawned in Jack's eyes, or maybe just a little consciousness. I'd settle for that. Her nightmare, her boogeyman, whatever she was afraid of when the lights went out, I said. It's just another ghost, Jack.
How do you know?
For one thing, it's flickering like an old movie, Wireman said. Look at it. The black man was gone, then there again, this time in front of the rust-encrusted ladder leading up to the pool's diving platform. It grinned at us from beneath its red cap. Its shirt, I saw, was as blue as its breeches. It slid from place to place with its unmoving legs always cocked in the same position like a figure in a shooting gallery. It was gone again, then appeared on the porch. A moment later it was in the driveway, almost directly in front of us. Looking at it made my head hurt, and still made me afraid, but only because she had been afraid. Libet. The next time it showed itself, it was on the double rutted path to the shade beach, and this time we could see the gulf shining through its blouse and breeches. It winked out of sight, and Wireman began to laugh hysterically.
What?
Jack turned to him, almost turned on him.
What?
It's a fucking lawn jockey, Wireman said, laughing harder than ever. One of those black lawn jockeys that are now so politically verboten, blown up to 3, maybe 4 times its normal size. Elizabeth's boogeyman was the house lawn jockey. He tried to say more, but he couldn't. He leaned over, laughing so hard he had to brace his hands on his knees. I saw the joke, but couldn't share it. And not only because my daughter was dead in Rhode Island. Wireman was only laughing now because at first he had been as frightened as Jack and I. As frightened as Libet must have been. And why had she been frightened? Because someone, quite likely by accident, had put the wrong idea in her imaginative little head. My money was on Nan Melda, and maybe a bedtime story meant only to soothe a child who was still fretful from her head injury. Maybe even insomniac. Only this bedtime story had lodged in the wrong place and grown teeth. Mr. Bluebritches wasn't like the frogs we'd seen back on the road, either. Those had been all Elizabeth, and there had been no malevolence about them. The lawn jockey, however, he might originally have come from little Libet's battered head, but I had an idea that Percy had long since appropriated him for her own purposes. If anyone got this close to Elizabeth's first home, there it was, all ready to scare the intruder away. Into a stay at the nearest lunatic asylum, maybe. Which meant there might be something here to find after all. Jack looked nervously toward where the sunken path, which really did look as if it had been big enough to accommodate a cart or even a truck once upon a time, dropped down and out of sight.
Will it be back?
It doesn't matter, muchacho, Wireman said. It's not real. That picnic basket, on the other hand, needs to be carried, so mush on, you huskies.
Just looking at it made me feel like I was losing my mind. Jack said. Do you understand that, Edgar?
Of course. Libet had a very powerful imagination back in the day.
What happened to it then?
She forgot how to use it.
Jesus, Jack said, that's horrible.
Yes, and I think that kind of forgetting is easy, which is even more horrible. Jack bent down, picked up the basket, then looked at Wireman.
What's in here, gold bars?
Wireman grabbed the bag of food and smiled serenely.
I packed a few extras.
We worked our way up the overgrown driveway, keeping an eye out for the lawn jockey. It did not return. At the top of the porch steps, Jack set the picnic basket down with a little sigh of relief. From behind us came a flurry and flutter of wings. We turned and saw a heron alight on the driveway. It could have been the same one that had been giving me the cold eye from El Palacio's tennis court. Certainly the gaze was the same. Blue and sharp and without an ounce of pity.
Is that real? Wireman asked.
What do you think, Edgar?
It's real, I said.
How do you know? I could have pointed out that the heron was casting a shadow, but for all I knew, the lawn jockey had been casting one as well. I had been too amazed to notice. I just do. Come on, let's go inside. And don't bother knocking. This isn't a social call. 13. This could be a problem, Jack said.
The veranda was deeply shadowed by mats of hanging Spanish moss, but once our eyes had adjusted to the gloom, we could see a thick and rusty chain encircling the double doors. Not one, but two padlocks hung down from it. The chain had been run through hooks on either jamb. Wireman stepped forward for a closer look.
You know, he said, Jack and I might be able to snap one or both of those hooks right off. They've seen better days.
Better years, Jack said.
Maybe, I said. But the doors themselves are almost certainly locked, and if you go rattling chains and snapping hooks, you're going to disturb the neighbors.
Neighbors? Wireman asked.
I pointed straight up. Wireman and Jack followed my finger and saw what I already had. A large colony of brown bats sleeping in what looked like a vast hanging cloud of cobweb. I glanced down and saw the porch was not just coated but plated with guano. It made me very glad I was wearing a hat. When I looked up again, Jack Cantore was at the foot of the steps.
No way, baby, he said. Call me a chicken, call me a candy ass, call me any name in the book. I'm not going there. With Wireman, it's snakes. With me, it's bats. Once,
he looked like he had more to say, maybe a lot, but didn't know how to say it. He took another step back instead. I had a moment to contemplate the eccentricity of fear. What the weird jockey hadn't been able to accomplish. Close, but that only counts in horseshoes. A colony of sleeping brown bats had. For Jack, at least.
Wireman said, They can carry rabies, muchacho. Did you know that?
I nodded. I think we should look for the tradesman's entrance.
14. We made our way slowly along the side of the house, Jack in the lead and carrying the red picnic basket. His shirt was dark with sweat, but he no longer showed the slightest sign of nausea. He should have. Probably we all should have. The stench from the pool was nearly overpowering. Thigh-high grass wickered against our pants. Stiff fiddlewood stems poked at our ankles. There were windows, but unless Jack wanted to try standing on Wireman's shoulders, they were all too high.
What time is it? Jack puffed.
Time for you to move a little faster, mi amigo, Wireman said. You want me to spell you on that basket?
Sure, Jack said, sounding really out of temper for the first time since I'd met him. Then you can have a heart attack, and me and the boss can try out our CPR technique.
Are you suggesting I'm not in shape?
In shape, but I still put you 50 pounds into the cardiac danger zone.
Quit it, I said, both of you.
Put it down, son, Wireman said. Put that queso de puta madre down, and I'll carry it the rest of the way.
No, forget it.
Something black moved in the corner of my eye. I almost didn't look. I thought it was the lawn jockey again. This time darting alongside the pool, or skimming its buggy, smelly surface. Thank God I decided to make sure.
Wireman, meanwhile, was glowering at Jack. His manhood had been impugned.
I want to spell you.
A piece of the pool's turgid nastiness had come alive. It detached itself from the blackness and flopped onto the cracked, weed-sprouting concrete lip, splattering muck about itself in a dirty starburst.
No, Wireman, I got it.
A piece of nastiness with eyes.
Jack, I'm telling you for the last time.
Then I saw the tail and realized what I was looking at.
And I'm telling you,
Wireman, I said and grabbed his shoulder.
No, Edgar, I can do this.
I can do this. How those words clanged in my head. I forced myself to speak slowly, loudly, and emphatically.
Wireman, shut up. There's an alligator. It just came out of the pool.
Wireman was afraid of snakes. Jack was afraid of bats. I had no idea I was afraid of alligators until I saw that chunk of prehistoric darkness separate itself from the decaying stew in the old pool and come for us. First across the overgrown concrete, brushing aside the last surviving tipped-over lawn chair as it did, and then sliding into the weeds and vines trailing down from the nearest Brazilian peppers. I caught one glimpse of its snout wrinkling back, one black eye squeezing shut in what could have been a wink, and then there was only its dripping back protruding here and there through the shivering greenery, like a submarine that's three quarters under. It was coming for us, and after telling Wireman I could do no more. Grayness came over my sight. I leaned back against the old warped boards of Heron's Roost. They were warm. I leaned there and waited to be eaten by the 12-foot-long thing that lived in John Eastlake's old swimming pool. Wireman never hesitated. He stripped the red basket from Jack's hands, dropped it on the ground, and knelt beside it, flipping back one end as he did so. He reached inside and produced the largest handgun I had ever seen outside of a motion picture. Kneeling there in the high grass with the open picnic basket in front of him, Wireman gripped it in both hands. I had a good angle on his face, and I thought then, and still think now, that he looked perfectly serene, especially for a man facing what could be seen as a snake writ large. He waited.
"Shoot it!" Jack screamed.
Wireman waited, and beyond him I saw the heron. It was floating in the air above the long, overgrown utility building behind the tennis court. It was floating upside down. "Wireman," I said, "safety catch?"
"Carai," he murmured and flicked something with his thumb.
A red spot high on the pistol's hand grip winked out of view. He never took his eyes from the high grass, which had now begun to shake. Then it parted, and the alligator came at him. I'd seen them on the Discovery Channel and National Geographic specials, but nothing prepared me for how fast that thing could move on those stub legs. The grass had brushed most of the mud from its rudiment of a face, and I could see its enormous smile.
"Now!"
Jack screamed. Wireman shot. The report was tremendous. It went rolling away like something solid, something made of stone. And the result was tremendous as well. The top half of the alligator's head came off in a cloud of mud, blood, and flesh. It didn't slow down. To the contrary, those stubby legs seemed to speed up as it ran off the last 30 feet or so. I could hear the grass wickering harshly along its plated sides. The barrel of the gun rose with the recoil. Wireman let it. I've never seen calm like that, and it still amazes me. When the gun came back to dead level, the alligator was no more than 15 feet away. He fired again, and the second bullet lifted the thing's front half to the sky, revealing a greenish-white belly. For a moment it seemed to be dancing on its tail, like a happy gator in a Disney cartoon.
"Yeah, you ugly bastard," Jack screamed. "Fuck your mother. Fuck your grandmother."
The gun rose again with the recoil. Once again, Wireman led it. The alligator thumped down on its side, belly exposed, the stubs of its legs thrashing, its tail whipping and tearing up grass and earth and clots. When the muzzle came back level, Wireman pulled the trigger again, and the center of the thing's belly seemed to disintegrate. All at once, the ragged, flattened circle in which it lay was mostly red instead of green. I looked for the heron. The heron was gone. Wireman got up. I saw he was shaking. He walked toward the alligator, although not quite within radius of the still-whipping tail, and pumped two more rounds into it. The tail gave a final convulsive whack against the ground, the body a final jerk, and then it was still. He turned to Jack and held up the automatic in a shaking hand. "Desert Eagle 357, he said. "One big old handgun made by badass Hebrews. James McMurtry, 2006. Mostly what added to the weight of the basket was the ammo. I tossed in all the clips I had, that was about a dozen." Jack walked over to him, embraced him, then kissed him on both cheeks. "I'll carry that basket to Cleveland if you want, and never say a word."
"At least you won't have to carry the gun," Wireman said. "From now on, sweet old Betsy McCall goes in my belt."
And he put it there, after loading a fresh clip and carefully re-engaging the safety. This took him two tries because of his shaking hands. I came over to him and also kissed him on each cheek.
"Oh, gosh," he said. "Wireman no longer feels Spanish. Wireman is beginning to feel positively French."
"How do you happen to have a gun in the first place?" I asked.
"It was Miss Eastlake's idea, after the last cocaine skirmish in Tampa St. Pete."
He turned to Jack. "You remember, don't you?"
"Yeah, 4 dead. Anyway, Miss Eastlake suggested I get a gun for home protection. I got a big one. She and I even did some target practice together."
He smiled.
"She was good, and she didn't mind the noise, but she hated the recoil."
He looked at the splattered alligator.
"I guess it did the job. What next, muchacho?"
"Around back, but did either of you see that heron?"
Jack shook his head, so did Wireman, looking bemused.
I saw it, I told him. And if I see it again, or if either of you do, I want you to shoot it, Jerome. Wireman raised his eyebrows but said nothing. We resumed our tramp along the east side of the deserted estate. 15. Finding a way in through the back turned out not to be a problem. There was no back. All but the most easterly corner of the mansion had been torn off, probably in the same storm that had taken the top stories. Standing there looking into the overgrown ruin of what had once been a kitchen and pantry, I realized that Heron's Roost was little more than a moss-festooned facade. "We can get in from here," Jack said doubtfully, "but I'm not sure I trust the floor. What do you think, Edgar?"
"I don't know," I said.
I felt very tired. Maybe it was only the spent adrenaline from our encounter with the alligator, but it felt more than that to me. It felt like defeat. There had been too many years, too many storms. And a little girl's drawings were ephemeral things to start with. "What time is it, Wireman? Without the bullshit, if you please." He looked at his watch. 2:30. "What do you say, muchacho? Go in?"
"I don't know," I repeated.
"Well, I do," he said. "I killed a fucking alligator to get here. I'm not leaving without at least a look around the old homestead. The pantry floor looks solid, and it's the closest to the ground. Come on, you two, let's pile up some shit to stand on. A couple of those beams should do. Jack, you can go first, then help me. We'll pull Edgar up together." And that's how we did it, dirty and disheveled and out of breath, scrambling first into the pantry and going from there into the house itself, looking around with wonder, feeling like time travelers, tourists in a world that had ended over 80 years before.